is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, welcome one and all to your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual. That's right, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grahamian Report, coming to you live from the dark heart of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, where we bring you news from beyond the fringe every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe by KGRARadio.com. Boy, a lot to cover tonight, and first and foremost, of course, happy Veterans Day to all you veterans out there. We'll have some news on that, as well as news, sadly, of the passing of an icon, a couple of them, in truth, and in addition to their influence on science fiction and fantasy, we're going to look also at how certain creations in film have inspired real-life advancements in things like AI and spacefaring. But then later in the program, on the subject of AI and space, I also want to turn our attention to the idea of alien life, and whether it's out there, as well as, of course, those claims of those who say that they know firsthand. That's right, what's really going on with alien abduction, close encounters of the third kind, and the rich literature that supposes that some have actually had such contact. I have a lot of different mixed feelings about that subject, which is part of the reason it's not a traditional subject I observe on this program all that much. I'm very interested, as listeners of this program know, very interested in the idea of unexplained aerial phenomena. But I've been troubled, you might say, by the idea that UFOs and the alien question are exclusive to one another. I don't think it's crazy necessarily to discuss either of them. I mean, NASA and many of our great astronomers are out there on a daily basis looking for evidence of alien life elsewhere in our universe. On the other side of that coin, we've also got agencies and government, as we know, that have taken interest over the decades in the idea that there may be structured craft of unexplained origin, and that this is something that should be taken seriously, not only from a strategic or from a national defense standpoint, but also in the eventuality that if we are dealing with some kind of a technology that is far more esoteric in terms of its origin than maybe just something Russia has or something China has. I mean, as concerning as that possibility is, and as real as I think that those possibilities are, the whole point, I think, in calling these things unidentified flying objects is that we don't know their origin. And so, broadly speaking, people in science, you know, academicians, and people in government agencies have definitely taken interest in the idea that there may be esoteric aircraft, structured craft of unknown origin. They're very interested in the possibility not only that alien life may exist out there, whether it's microbial life on a nearby planet, or whether it's intelligent life much further out. We're interested in all these possibilities, but it doesn't necessarily mean that because people see strange aircraft in the skies, that alien life exists and it's been coming to Earth for decades, maybe for hundreds if not thousands of years. I mean, again, you see all these, what I think are in large part fantasies that have been woven around the unequivocal association many make between alien life and weird aircraft that are seen from time to time. But if you go back to the tail end of the Second World War, where does the alien meme come from? Because it's certainly not something that is explicitly tied to claims of alien abduction. That's one weird aspect of the entire subculture. Again, and we'll get more into this in the second hour, but to give you the teaser right here at the outset, you got to remember at the end of the Second World War, the Allies are victorious. The U.S. brings back home after the conflict certain German rocket scientists, guys like Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth. I mean, they come back over and they essentially become the fathers of the U.S. space program. And so we think that we have the best of the best working for us. And then you have things like this happen. August morning, 1946, Captain Jack Puckett of Strategic Air Command is flying en route to MacDill Air Force Base with his crew when they say that they see an object that they think initially is a meteor. And it's headed straight for them. And naturally, they're concerned that whatever this object is going to collide with them. And then suddenly, it moves out of the direct flight path, narrowly misses a collision. They get a look at it. Some of the crew and Captain Puckett, they describe an aircraft that was roughly double the size of the fuselage of a B-17, but with no wings. There were lights on the aircraft of some kind. There was reddish smoke and sparkles, they said, shooting out of the back like there was some sort of a rocket engine. There were even windows, they described, on the craft. And they watched it, still frightened, from this near midair collision with this thing that they can't identify that looks sort of like a rocket of some kind, some sort of an airship. They're not sure what it is. And you can imagine what would happen to a captain with Strategic Air Command if he makes up some cockamamie story about seeing some sort of a big rocket or airship that nearly collides with his plane. I mean, right after World War II like this, I mean, if he had been lying, if he and his entire crew, for that matter, had decided that they wanted to cook up some crazy story, and they were later found to have been perpetrating a hoax, I mean, it would have been worse than court-martialing, right? You don't joke around about what appears like an advanced aircraft that may be of enemy origin months after the end of the greatest conflict between nations in our time. That is not something that happens, right? And so descriptions of sightings like this were taken very seriously. I mean, this was of extreme national security importance. And in the predecessors to what became Project Blue Book under the U.S. Air Force, newly formed separate branch of the government, no longer under the oversight of the U.S. Army, the U.S. Air Force, before they actually start the Project Blue Book thing, I mean, there had been a couple of similar predecessors, Project Sign, Project Grudge, and there had been at one time this so-called estimate of the situation that was put out. I believe Major Donald Kehoe, popular UFO writer that he was back in the day, back in the 1950s, he had probably been the one that first brought to public knowledge this so-called estimate of the situation, and no copies of it still exist, but thanks to the work of guys like Barry Greenwood and, of course, Paul Dean, my Australian friend who came on the show, and we did a lengthy discussion about some of the things he's found from U.S. government files by filing Freedom of Information Act requests in relation to UFO search terms and things. But there is the so-called ghost of the estimate, where there are summaries of the actual intelligence report that the U.S. Air Force not only wrote, but apparently only distributed internally, and then all copies were destroyed. There was this estimate of the situation where they were trying to discern, based on all the available data, what the UFO phenomena was. I don't even think at that time that they were being called UFOs. That acronym was later adopted in the early 50s after it was proposed by the first head of Project Blue Book, Edward Ruppelt, and he wrote a great book called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects that I think anyone professing interest in this subject should read. And if you haven't, you definitely need to. It was very unsensational. And there was a later edition of the book that he put out a few years later where he kind of toned down some of the UFO narrative and became much more skeptical himself. And there's a lot of speculation for reasons about that. But anyway, coming back to that estimate of the situation, presumably Ruppelt would have seen that and known about that as well. Why all the copies were destroyed, who knows. But in the estimate, they were taking the best data that they had at that time and trying to understand what we were looking at, what we were dealing with. And some of the characteristics of aircraft, like those seen by Captain Jack Puckett and others, some of the better cases, both military and Air Force, and also civilian cases, they were looking at the data and said, look, we can't rule out the possibility that some of these things may not even be ours. They may not be from Earth at all. And I think that's really kind of where the first serious insinuation of an alien connection with the so-called UFO phenomena began. Again, some of the best minds that were looking at the phenomenon at that time were saying, what are we dealing with? That was one idea that they came up with. I mean, it's an inevitable conclusion, and in some ways, it's also a logical conclusion as well, even if it is unlikely as a possible scenario. I mean, we still don't know. We know very little more about this so-called phenomenon so many decades later than the folks who were making those assessments at that time did. And although that may have been the beginning of the idea, I think that there had already been memes in science fiction. I mean, you can go back and look at the old pulp magazine covers. The idea of an alien invasion was not something that came about only after the dawn of the so-called UFO era. It wasn't after Kenneth Arnold saw objects over Mount Rainier in the summer of 1947 that we start thinking about alien abductions or alien invasions or weird-looking creatures with scaly skin flying around in aircraft from far-off places. I mean, all these things were firmly planted already in the public consciousness by the time the UFO thing arrived. And although they had existed in fiction, when we start seeing aircraft in the skies that we can't explain and which the authorities can't explain, our government doesn't seem to know whose they are or what they are here for, what they're capable of. I mean, people already had the meme firmly implanted in their minds. It didn't take much for them to leap to the next conclusion, which is, God, these things could be aliens just like what you see in the films or like you've read in the comic books or the pulp magazines. And you look back at those magazine covers from the 20s and 30s and 40s, and you'll see the beautiful woman tied to a table with ghastly-looking alien beings around her, examining her or him, and then there'll be technological devices in an environment that's very alien. We don't know what they all do. I mean, all the elements of a so-called alien abduction already existed in fiction by the time that people in the 1950s, starting off with guys like George Adamski, begin to claim that they have met the visitors, that the people in the aircraft have actually touched down in the desert, come out, and spoken with us. It starts off with the friendly space brothers. The so-called aliens look a lot like us. Very suspiciously, they look exactly like humans. Some of them even speak English. And as silly as so many of those early reports are, as unimaginative as they are on part of the so-called contactees who claim that they had those experiences, the narrative does begin to shift within just a couple of decades. And by the 1970s and 80s, the majority of books written on UFOs incorporated claims of those who said that they had encounters. And so what we've got to try and do is make sense of all that and understand the cultural narratives, you know, where these ideas come from, as we've seen a little of already, but more importantly, what to make, if there's anything to be made, of those claims of those who say that they've had these experiences firsthand. We'll look at the history of all that and much more in the second hour. I do want to get to a little news right now, and of course, first and foremost, my heart goes out to everybody over there in California. Around this time, every year it seems like a significant chunk of the United States is on fire, and with all the rain and the cold I've had over here on the East Coast, I just wish I could get a great big blast of wind to blow all this rain we've had out there in that direction. I realize so many of you could use it right now. The AP reported earlier today that his relatives desperately searched shelters for missing loved ones on Sunday. Crews searching the smoking ruins of Paradise and outlying areas found six more bodies, raising the death toll to 29, that matching the deadliest wildfire in California history. Now, wildfires continued to rage on both ends of the state with gusty winds expected overnight, which will challenge firefighters. The statewide death toll, they said, stood at 31. The campfire that ravaged a swath of Northern California was the deadliest. Now, right now, they've got about 10 search and recovery teams working in that Paradise area. That's a town, by the way, of about 27,000. It was largely, and this is the AP zone term that they use, they say Paradise was incinerated on Thursday, and in surrounding communities, apparently authorities called in a mobile DNA lab and anthropologists just to help identify victims of the most destructive wildfire there in California history. And yet, this has actually hit some folks close to home here. You know, L.A. Marzulli is one of the hosts here on KGRA Radio, and I was just told by one of our producers this evening that L.A.'s house was destroyed and that he's essentially lost everything. And he now has a GoFundMe account just trying to raise funds so he can start over again, he and his family. It's so heartbreaking. And for those who are interested, by the way, a Google search for L.A. Marzulli GoFundMe Fire Recovery Fund or something similar to that will bring it up. I actually tested that, and so you should be able to find his page. But he was one of the many who have been affected by all this. Now, Governor Jerry Brown has said he is reaching out to the Trump administration for aid. He said managing all the forests everywhere we can does not stop climate change. And those who deny that are definitely contributing to the tragedies that we're now witnessing and will continue to witness in the coming years. I believe that Trump was quoted saying that poor forest management is what causes these fires. I have no further comment. I'm just going to leave that one right there. But needless to say, my heart goes out to everybody out there who's been affected. I mean, the lives who've been lost, this is a situation that, again, there's going to be a lot of relief effort. And I certainly hope that in the coming weeks, we can continue to give information about how you can donate, how you can help. There are a lot of people out there right now who are going to need it. Now, that said, as I was prepping for the show today, of course, the news about California and the wildfires isn't the only sad news. Unfortunately, I have to report tonight that we have lost Another icon in the entertainment industry. I mentioned comic books a little earlier and the influence comic books had in the early part of the last century. But when it comes to those who are influential creators in the realm of comics and superheroes, there's probably no one who has been more famous, more well-loved and regarded than Stan Lee. And it's been reported by TMZ and other news outlets that Stan Lee passed away, this confirmed by his daughter. They said, and I quote, "We're told an ambulance rushed to Lee's Hollywood Hills home early Monday morning, and he was rushed to Cedars Sinai Medical Center. We're told that's where he died. Lee had suffered several illnesses over the last year or so. He had a bout of pneumonia and vision issues as well. Stan started Marvel with Jack Kirby back in 1961 with the Fantastic Four. He went on to create Spider-Man, Black Panther, The Incredible Hulk, X-Men, Iron Man, and The Avengers. Stan made cameo appearances, of course, in all the Marvel movies as well.
I'm pretty proud of the fact that some of the stories that I wrote so many years ago are still being read and hopefully enjoyed by the public, and people are making motion pictures based on them, and Spider-Man is my favorite because he's the most popular and he's known and loved worldwide.
Lee's spidey senses were tingling. Years later, in 2002, the first Spider-Man film was released and was a blockbuster hit.
As a child, I didn't really know anybody who shot webs or crawled on buildings or wore suits of armor and flew or anything like that. I just imagined them, and there they were.
I think every child at some point imagines things that aren't really there and creates of their fertile imagination superheroes or characters, things like this. Again, going back to the decades well in advance of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's creation of Marvel Comics, aliens, alien abductions, alien invasions, all these kind of things were present as well. But the other side of this is you look at the characters that Stan Lee created and how inspiring many of them are. I mean, you think about Peter Parker. He said that Spider-Man was his favorite. And Peter Parker's a nerd, and he gets bitten by the radioactive spider. It gives him special powers, but again, there are these lasting themes. His Uncle Ben, right before he dies, telling Peter Parker, with great power comes great responsibility. And so Peter Parker chooses to use his powers to protect and to stop evil and to generally attempt to try and make the lives of those around him better, and sometimes saving the world. And of course, all the heroes in the Marvel universe are doing that. And much like the gods of yore, you know, in ancient times we had our mythologies and we had epic adventures of mythical kings and heroes, Hercules, Gilgamesh, Beowulf. You know, the superheroes today are in very many ways those same sorts of mythic characters. Some of them, like Thor, literally are mythic characters from Norse mythology, which were, borrowed and made into comic book characters. And in these characters, much like the gods that people worshipped in the ancient past, in the superheroes of today, we can find a version of ourselves, maybe a stronger version, or the kind that we want to be that we can't always be. And we can tap into that strength. I know when I was a kid, I loved Spider-Man and would collect old Spider-Man comic books. I mean, if we went into an old comic shop and there were old comics from the 70s and 80s, I mean, those things were just magical to me. And at one point, I even wanted to be a comic artist. There was a great book that Stan Lee co-authored, I believe, with John Buscema. And it was called How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. You can still buy the book, but I found that book somewhere. A friend of mine found it and bought a copy, and then I went out to the store and bought one too. And the kids were just mystified by this. They'd see my buddy and I with our copies of this book that teaches you how to draw comics, and we were all like, whoa, you mean you can learn how to do that? And I remember as recently as the seventh grade, a teacher asking me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I really plan on being an artist. I wanted to be an artist. Well, my brother ended up being the comic artist. Caleb is a fantastic comic artist, in fact. I ended up being the writer and the broadcaster. But, we each find our path. And I think that for many of us, sometimes, especially when we're young, finding that path is the inspiration that we draw from heroes, whether those who are real or those which we see on the printed page. But I've had friends over the years say, I don't see why you like superhero movies and comic books and stuff like that, Mike. I mean, I don't spend all my time watching superhero movies nowadays. I rarely even have the time, but I do still enjoy them from time to time. And I've mentioned a few times on the show the Netflix series, based on the Marvel characters, Daredevil and others, and I've enjoyed some of those. A lot of people don't get the superhero thing, but to me, again, it's an extension of our mythic past, the archetypes that, people have kept with them since time immemorial. And just like the heroes of the ancient past that were created and fictionalized, sometimes based on reality. You see the same thing with comic book characters and heroes like these. But then you look at characters like the X-Men. And in a lot of ways, Marvel always was, and Stan Lee right from the outset, was trying to provide commentary on culture. I mean, the X-Men could have represented any number of different cultural groups or ideas. And some have said that, again, it was basically an ongoing commentary on the idea of fear of the other. And here you have the X-Men who are trying to do good and trying to save the world, but nonetheless, throughout their history, right from the early days, they were also being attacked because people were innately afraid of what they didn't understand. Think about how much of that we still see in the world today. People are still fearful and therefore hateful toward people who are different from them, whether it's in appearance or attitudes, beliefs. As much as we advance as a society, as a civilization, we've still got a lot of hurdles. And Stan Lee was somebody with his characters and with the art that went into the stories in the Marvel comics that he contributed to over the years, that they were very mindful of all these issues and that they were always trying to offer perspectives through fiction stories and narratives that dealt with real life issues. So Stan was really the man in that sense. I mean, he really was a cultural icon for more than just creating characters that we all like. Those characters meant something to him, and there were reasons why he created them. And the stories behind those characters dealt with real issues in the real world that we're still facing. And, you know, inspires us in a lot of ways to try and reach down in ourselves and find our own inner superheroes to be better to one another. I think that really there's a good case for a lot more of that happening in the world right now. I want to get to some Veterans Day stuff in the next segment, too. One more quick story, and this was kind of bizarre. Imagine this kind of a job. Okay, a company in Australia created a new position that will likely send beer enthusiasts into a frenzy, reported by thisisinsider.com. They said the job titled Chief Clock Off Officer requires, this is so bizarre, okay, requires the individual to encourage others to finish work early so they can drink beer with their friends every day of the week. This is in Sydney, for those who are interested in trying to maybe fill this position, and it is for a beer company, which partly explains the reason that they are looking for someone who will assist in getting others to finish work early and go and enjoy a beer. Yeah, it almost sounds like a joke, or like at very least it's too good to be true, but now here's the deal, okay? Sydney Beer Company released the online application for the job just a couple of weeks ago, stating that the aim of the position is to promote the Sydney Time movement, all right? You may be asking yourself, if you don't live in Sydney, Australia, what is the Sydney Time Movement? Well, it's all about enjoying the city of Sydney to the full by leaving work early on a daily basis, getting together with friends and drinking beer. Now, in part of the job description, they say, are you an avid bar and beer selfie poster? Are you more likely to know where to meet for a beer than where your next work meeting is? Do you specialize in time away from your desk, enjoying the very best that Sydney has to offer? If the answer is a big fat yes to these questions, we want you. Now, this may sound kind of silly, but I want to point out two things. First and foremost, a lot of jobs these days, a lot of businesses, are actually encouraging a homier kind of a feel in the office place. You know, instead of cubicles and desks, there are a lot of businesses these days that have couches and they have kind of a more open work environment where people can be comfortable. I mean, like if you were at home. I think that the difference between literally working at home, as I do, and having an office that feels a lot more like a home is the fact that, of course, if you are more comfortable, it's a little more conducive to relaxation. People aren't getting as stressed out. People aren't fighting as much. I mean, some offices, I kid you not, they'll often have coffee and they'll have a really nice kitchen area. Some of them even have beer on tap. It's no joke. But the other side of it too is that I had mentioned, I think last week, that after working just mindlessly for so long, I finally have kind of made a new resolution. I'm taking off at least one day each weekend. I had to work a little this weekend, but I actually only worked part of the day on Saturday, and then I got the heck out of the office, you know, which for me is, again, the Graylian bunker. But, I mean, it has done wonders for my mentality, just forcing myself to get out of the office, so to speak. And even if your office is at home, again, being able to change your perspective on things by making things a little more comfortable, whether that's getting out of the office or whether that's making the office feel more like home, these things do tend to increase not only productivity, but also, I think, the morale among workers. And this whole idea that the office has to be this sterile kind of an environment and everybody hates their job because they don't like where they're going to work. I mean, imagine if you had an office area at your place of employment that was so comfortable that people loved spending time there, you know? And that's exactly what a lot of businesses are doing these days. So, you know, there's something to be said about that, too. And on this subject, by the way, of getting out, being social, enjoying a fine brew with your friends, or even having an office that might have beer on tap that you can enjoy a little more. I mean, granted, typically you're not going to see people at work standing around drinking beer, right? But I'm saying for like special events and occasions and things like that. I know when I worked in radio, our general manager was a big advocate of at least twice a year, we would have a day where nobody worked. We would have a big picnic or something like that. They'd have great big tubs of, you know, it was usually American beers, not my favorite types, but, you know, with the craft brew revolution and with Sierra Nevada now living here in Asheville, North Carolina, you know, it's hard to find bad beer in this part of town. But what if I told you you could actually have some of the best beer in the world right from the comfort of your home, whether or not you work from home? What if I told you you could have beer on tap right inside your house, right on your countertop in your kitchen, or anywhere else in your house that you'd like to have it? Well, I want to take a minute to tell you about Hopsy. Aren't they a new sponsor of the program? And I couldn't be more excited about having them on board. In fact, seldom do I get this excited about a sponsorship. If you listen to this show frequently, again, you know I love different rich beverages, not just beer. And whether it's coffee starting off my day or enjoying a fine dark stout in the evening, you know, the coffee lovers these days know it's easy to get a delicious cup of coffee in just seconds with things like Keurig machines. Again, you just push a button, basically, and in no time flat, you've got a delicious cup of coffee. But I think that the craft beer lovers in our midst have been wondering, okay, the coffee nuts have got their quick on-demand delicious coffee at the push of a button. What about the beer lovers? I mean, we've been in a bit of a craft brew revolution now for several years, and yet there hasn't been an at-home equivalent to the machines that coffee lovers enjoy for the stout or the pale ale or the ever-popular IPA that enthusiasts out there no doubt enjoy. Well, look, it's time for you to rejoice, my friends, because the day has finally arrived, and that's where Hopsy comes into the picture, H-O-P-S-Y. And Hopsy is the Keurig for beer, and with the help of their unique sub-draft system, pouring fresh draft beer right from your countertop is finally a reality. Trust me, I know, because they were kind enough to send me one of these things, and it's not only really easy to set up, but I was amazed at how faithful the flavor is. I mean, I thought it might taste kind of like draft beer. No, no, it is draft beer from your countertop, and it is amazing. I even made a video really quickly and sent it to the guys from Seven Ages just to show them how it works. It's really quite incredible, and it all has to do with the magic that is the sub-draft system. It's a countertop appliance that fits neatly in your kitchen, bar, or living room. I'd say it's maybe twice the size of a good-sized toaster, maybe a little larger than a crock pot, right? So that gives you an idea of the general size. And once you order yours, you fill it by inserting one of Hopsy's mini kegs into it. It chills it, and then when the light turns green, it lets you know it's cold enough to serve, and then you're ready to go. And that's all there is to it. Now look, we also have got to talk about the beers that they offer. And let me tell you, they've got something for everybody, because Hopsy partners with a long list of wonderful breweries and ships mini kegs to your home or maybe your office. And yes, they have a wonderful selection of IPAs. Those are really kind of the it beer right now. And I went to their website and looked around, and they've got all kinds of great IPAs. But if you're like me and you prefer stouts and porters, they've got lots of those too. They literally have everything, and they rotate each month with different regions, different craft breweries. So there's always something new, always something for everybody. But about those India Pale Ales, I want to talk about that for a minute, because these are really popular these days. India Pale Ale IPA. Of course, there's a bit of history behind this. Back in the old days, when Britain was sending beer to the colonies in India, and they would barrel it up and they would send it, it would have to be at sea for quite a while. And sometimes when the beer actually arrived in India, they would find that with the heat of transport and the time that it spent in the barrel, that some of the beer had spoiled. And so to get over this, what they started doing was they started brewing the beer with a higher alcohol content. Not only did this allow the beer to be better preserved and it could make it all the way across the ocean to India, but people began to find that they liked the flavor. They liked the punch that it packed. And these days, a lot of craft breweries are experimenting with different kinds of extremely hoppy IPAs, because generally people just love that flavor. And it's really kind of taken the craft brewery scene by storm. And so you can guarantee that Hopsy is in on this, and that they have an excellent selection of some of the best IPAs around, in my opinion. Now, look, if you're ready to enjoy delicious craft brewed IPAs or any other kind of beer on tap at home like we do here in the Grayland Bunker, it's time for you to head over to tryhopsy.com/TGR. And then when you get there, use the promo code TGR, as in the Grayland Report. That will get you the sub home draft machine, two mini kegs of beer, that's equivalent to about 2 6-packs, two Hopsy glasses, and free membership in the monthly beer club, and all of that for just $99. Can you believe that? Almost couldn't when they sent me mine. Now listen, terms and conditions do apply, but let me spell it out for you. Literally, it's H-O-P-S-Y, Hopsy. And again, to get the sub home draft machine, two mini kegs of beer equivalent to 2 6-packs, two Hopsy glasses, and free membership in the monthly beer club, all for just $99, all you have to do is go to tryhopsy.com/TGR and use the promo code TGR. That's tryhopsy, H-O-P-S-Y, tryhopsy.com/TGR. Use the promo code TGR. Trust me, if you enjoy a fine beverage at home on the weekends, or maybe as you're relaxing in the evenings after a hard day at work, this is going to be not only a game changer, it may change your life also. Check them out. All right, when we return, I want to touch a little bit on Veterans Day and some odd history associated with that, and then later in the program, AI and space travel. All of that awaits you here on the Graylian Report. Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRERadio.com. I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. We already wished our veterans out there a happy Veterans Day, but I do want to point out some interesting history about this year's celebration. Did you know that Veterans Day this year is also the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I? That's right. Many Hoosiers were important in the effort to stop aggression. This reported by WIBC.com. which started in 1914 and came to an end on November 11th, 1918. Today, they say, we recognize America's veterans for their dedicated service to our nation. Of course, Veterans Day is a time to honor the sacrifices of all who have served, as well as the sacrifices of their families. This according to U.S. Senator Todd Young, who said this in a statement yesterday. Now, Veterans Day, of course, is being observed on Monday with banks and the post office closed, and hence you may not have had your mail delivered either. I was standing there in the rain earlier today wondering why my mail hadn't been delivered before this all dawned on me, right? But speaking of veterans, I want to share a funny story with you that I found, and I actually have read about this before in the past, but going back to 1942, so this is going to be World War II, okay, there was a group of Polish prisoners of war, and they'd been traveling from a Siberian labor camp in Alexandria, Egypt, and found an unlikely companion in the mountains of modern-day Iran. It was a brown bear cub. And so they named this little cub Wojtek, although it's spelled W-O-J-T-E-K, but again, that Polish pronunciation, Wojtek. And kind of on the heels of the segment we did before the break talking about beer, this little guy was known, well, when he grew up, he was a big bear, and he liked beer. He really did. So some of his story from VinePeer.com goes as follows. They said, after leaving a Soviet gulag, the Polish prisoners came across the cub in Persia. The young bear was being kept in a sack by a shepherd boy, and so the weary men took in the bear as one of their own. They included him on their arduous journey through the Middle East, where a new Polish army was being formed to join the Allies in the fight against the Germans. Now, Wojtek eventually joined the 22nd Transport Company, Artillery Division, Polish 2nd Corps. The bear, that's right. He spent much of his time among the 4th Platoon, particularly with his two best friends, which were Dmitry Swilogo and Heinrich Zakharowicz. Now, when Wojtek was just a little cub, they gave him milk, right? Although they served it to him from a vodka bottle. But apparently as Wojtek grew older and larger, so did his hunger and his thirst. They said he was often found in the galley eating anything that he could. He ate oranges used for grenade practice, and they said that he'd sneak into the showers to drink water. And this posed a problem for the soldiers, whose water, of course, was rations. So they had to make a call. They opted to give a 500-pound bear their spare beer, wine, and cigarettes. And there are actually photographs of Wojtek. He'd be sitting there. He loved to smoke cigarettes. But I'm thinking they had to ration the water, but they had spare wine and beer enough to be able to give this 500-pound bear. Now, Swilogo actually said, we all loved him. and everybody enjoyed his company. He loved to drink from a beer bottle, and when it was empty, he would look through the opening to see where the rest of the beer was. I loved that. They said that he would accept lit cigarettes and take a puff, and if you weren't careful, they said he would swallow them. Swilago's accounts, they said, published online by his son Andreas, don't specify exactly what or how much Wojtek ate during the years that he was enlisted, but they say brown bear is one of the largest species in the world, or at the top of the food chain. A bear like Wojtek is capable of eating up to 90 pounds of food per day. In other words, keeping Wojtek happy and healthy was the epitome of a labor of love for the Polish soldiers. Now, in 1943, the regiment embarked for Italy, where they fought in the Battle of Monte Cassino, one of the Allies' costliest battles. The cub had grown into a courageous 500-plus-pound soldier. He did actually help move crates of ammunition, and there have been legends that he was out there on the front lines fighting, too. Now, historians know that because there are photographs of Wojtek. I mean, he really was part of the regiment, and he did actually help, but there's no evidence that he was actually out there fighting or that somebody was riding Wojtek, you know, riding a bear into combat or anything like that. They say it's unlikely that he took part in hand-to-hand combat, or maybe hand-to-paw combat in this case, but he did provide a great deal of help to his unit, and also just the camaraderie. They loved him. And you see these days in hospitals, animal therapy, you know, where dogs and cats are brought in for patients and things like this. During the strife that war brings, imagine having a lovable brown bear that drinks beer and smokes cigarettes with you. I mean, he actually raised morale among the regiment, too. The Polish soldiers, they say, were so appreciative that Wojtek's likeness was used on the regiment's official badge, which featured a large bear, the likeness of Wojtek, holding artillery in its two great big front paws. Yeah, so on this Veterans Day, we remember Wojtek, the beer-drinking, cigarette-smoking Polish war bear. Although he wasn't actually much of a fighter, Wojtek, according to all counts, seemed to have been more of a lover. So we raise our glass to you, Wojtek, and of course to all of you out there who are veterans and who have served and sacrificed to be able to preserve comfort and safety for us here at home. We cannot thank you enough for all that you have done. We remember you on this day and will never, never forget you. I want to, in the few minutes we have here before we go to the next break, I do want to touch on something interesting that was sent to me by Adam Olson. Adam always sends great stories. He and Lauren do so much of the prep, along with Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, so many people who are instrumental in keeping this ship afloat here at Team Graylian. But the story that Adam sent along was from the New Yorker, and it's talking about the mystery of the Havana Syndrome, as they call it. And yes, they are talking about the mystery of the issue that was occurring down there with people at the consulate in Cuba. You remember the so-called electronic weapon? And then this happens in China, too. And it's a very lengthy article, maybe the longest and most thorough that I've seen on this subject. But it's interesting because if you go to the New Yorker, one of the taglines they use these days is, "We fight fake news with real news," or something to that effect, which I found was kind of interesting because, of course, in this era that many critics call post-truth and the era of fake news and all this kind of stuff, and it doesn't just have to do with U.S. politics. I mean, it's really kind of a broader phenomena. As we're going to see a little later, there are some who would even call the kinds of things that we talk about on this program. Often I enjoy discussing fringe topics, but I try to do it from a responsible perspective. These days online, there's no distinction. If it is a fringe subject, it is fake news, it is conspiracy theory. I kind of have an issue with, you know, painting everything with a broad brush in that regard. There are plenty of college professors and responsible academics who have written about everything from alien abduction to mind control and the kind of stuff that we're about to discuss here with the embassy in Cuba. But see, that story, and that's what brought this to mind, in this so-called post-truth fake news era, people are so cautious of discussing certain subjects. And sure, you know, you should be cautious if something seems like it could be a little out there or unlikely. But if you remember with the whole situation down there at the U.S. consulate in Cuba, the sociologists initially were trying to say that this was just some sort of mass hysteria. And so this was fake news, in essence, in one way or another. I mean, it was real news. Something was really going on, but people were saying there wasn't some actual neurological disorder. And then we reported on that new study, which found, you know, actually, guys, now it's looking like this really was an attack. There really was an effect. And the people who said that they were experiencing something weren't just hallucinating. It wasn't just mass, you know, hysteria. There was something going on. And now even the scientists are saying, well, on further review, yeah, we think that there's something to this. So the New Yorker article reports that the few American diplomats who still work in Havana now live together in group houses set back at a cautious distance from the street. In recent weeks, the embassy has looked deserted with all the lights turned off at night. The north side of the chancery is cordoned off with yellow police tape, which reads, "Do not enter." Some of the walls and windows in the adjoining buildings have gaping holes, evidence of hurricane damage. And they say, "Our embassy is operating on life support. It cannot process visas. It cannot conduct effective diplomacy. It can't engage in human rights. In a time of political and economic transition in Cuba, our embassy has been sidelined. A Cuban seeking to travel to the U.S. must now apply for a visa in Guyana, 2,000 miles away." These are some of the effects of what's been going on down there. And again, to see this very lengthy article in the New Yorker talking about the state of affairs and this story as it's developed, something that initially people were saying, "Oh, come on, that's not real. This is highly unlikely." Now it's turning out that even if Cuba wasn't behind it, of course, a lot of people have suggested that Russia may be behind whatever the effects were that the people at the consulate were experiencing. But whatever the source of it is, it's been fascinating, and that's why I've continued to report on this story, seeing the way that it has progressed over time. And it went from being something that, of course, the New York Times and major periodicals were reporting on it, but I mean, many in the medical community were saying, there is nothing to see here. And furthermore, if we treat this as though this hysteria is anything more legitimate than just that hysteria, then our actual reputation is at stake. Lo and behold, that narrative has really shifted. Now you're seeing lengthy articles in the New Yorker about this, and you're seeing members of the medical community coming forward and saying, I mean, guys, what we probably overlooked initially now sticks out like a sore thumb. These people were affected by something. It's interesting in this information age of post-truths and fake news to see the evolution of a story like that. That's all I'm saying. To me, in fact, in a lot of ways, that's fascinating. And sometimes you have to look carefully, critically, and very cautiously at something before you can get to the bottom of what exactly is happening. And so when we come back from this break, I do want to get to a couple of listener emails, but I also want to look at the way that AI, okay, has been influenced and how there's this peculiar thing that you'll see where in movies, sometimes fictional ideas and concepts do influence things that happen in the real world. In one instance, I want to look at the way that has been the case with AI, how there have been things that we've seen in science fiction that have actually influenced some of the advancements in AI, but I also want to look at the way that fiction may have influenced culture in other ways. And yes, how some of that goes hand in hand with our ideas about alien contact, whether it actually occurs, or if in the eventual sense, whether it will, and how a lot of that indeed kind of flooded the UFO literature over the decades. We're going to look at all that when we return. It is the Graylian Report.
The Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Always glad to be here with you guys. Picked up some new subscribers over the weekend, and of course, usually at the top of the second hour, I like to remind all you guys out there who are subscribers how much I appreciate what you do to keep us afloat here at the Graylian Report. A lot of work goes into this program, and of course, I like to think of our subscriber packages as being a way you can show support for the program. If you enjoy the information, the entertainment, often the education that goes into the way that we try to approach these subjects, I think it's important to be able to look rationally at things that are associated with fringe claims. I also think it's important sometimes to debunk outright if necessary, but sometimes you'll see that there are weird aspects of our existence that are dismissed out of hand because they seem unlikely. And at times there is a way, both responsibly, intellectually, etc., to go about looking at these things. We try to do all that on the Graylian Report. If you enjoy it and you'd like to be able to get a little something extra for it, check out Graylian X. You can find that at graelienreport.com/X. And you can sign up. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. That gets you additional weekly podcasts and, of course, the monthly Graylian Enigmas special. And over the years, in fact, some of the subject matter that we're going to be discussing here later in the hour does have to do with claims of alien contact and things like that. And we've highlighted some of those cases on the Graylian Enigmas show over the years and tried to make heads or tails of them, as we will certainly try to do over the course of the next hour. But before we get to all that, I do want to touch on a couple of quick listener emails. And one of our newsies, Jan, has written in and said, you know, yesterday, which would have been Sunday, my husband said that he heard loud booms like thunder, except they were evenly spaced and over an extended period. Now, I heard nothing here in the house, but he was up on the mountain. He said he thought it was something off the coast. There's currently no fracking off the West Coast, and I'm pretty sure no drilling either. That's interesting, Jan, and thanks for the mystery boom report. Almost sounds like it could possibly be an aircraft. That is one possibility. But again, as I talked about last week, with some of that so-called mystery music that's been heard off the northeastern coast over here stateside, my guess is that the source of the mystery music that locals and even the authorities are pulling their hair out trying to find the source of is probably much further away, and it's probably atmospheric conditions that are conducive to that sound being carried over a great distance. And it could be that there's perhaps something out at sea that would cause those evenly spaced booms. Who knows what's going on? That's interesting, though, and it's a fairly atypical report. I'd love to hear how loud your husband said that they were, Jan, and thanks for taking a minute to write. Another friend of the program also wrote in, by the way, Alden. Alden Taylor, as he is known in certain quadrants of space-time, but he said, Eve, Micah, I just wanted to drop a line and give you a personal story about my chiropractic experiences. And this is in response to the segment we did last week on that. He said, I've been to two different chiro doctors for a total of 1 year. These are weekly appointments, apparently. And he said, this is to work on treating his back pain. And he said, I have an S-curve scoliosis in my spine, and I don't have the strongest back muscles due to lots of sitting at desks. Now, my second chiropractor did an X-ray and told me about what he called subluxations. And again, this is something we referenced last week, which he described as the individual vertebra being twisted out of alignment, and this causing light pinching on the nerves. Now, some of the issues I've had with this include losing feeling in the fingers and toes, headaches, back pain, etc. He said, my chiropractor did not mention that this could be a cause of things beyond back pain. He didn't make claims about non-nervous system related disorders or diseases. Based on this, I don't think he was a vitalist, though he certainly felt that chiropractic care could heal many elements. He treats many players in the Minnesota Vikings, and his office is about a football field away from Prince's house at Paisley Park. All of that said, I was surprised to hear on the recent Graylian that there is no evidence for the existence of the subluxations. What else might you call a twisted vertebra? Or was he mistaken in his assessment of my spine? He pointed out to me that you can tell when a vertebra is subluxated because when you apply light pressure, it hurts quite a lot, and it's localized to the vertebra. Weird stuff. I stopped going because it was expensive, and my back never really got better in the long term. But best wishes, Alden. And thanks, by the way, for taking time to write in, Alden. It's always good to hear from you. Again, I visited a chiropractor in the past myself, but this chiropractor had been a medical doctor before that. And last week, as I was doing that segment, it almost concerned me a little bit thereafter because I didn't want people, especially in our listening audience, especially those who may be members of the chiropractic community, I didn't want them to take it as though my intention was to say that all chiropractic is bunk. Quite the contrary. There are some people, and I'm sure that you know people who have a medical background in chiropractic are probably aware of the vitalists, and they may see that attitude as part of the problem too, that there is an element of pseudoscience which unfortunately many people associate broadly with chiropractic in the general sense. You know, I'm no expert on subluxations or chiropractic care for that matter, and I haven't been to one in years. Again, it's interesting to me that, like a lot of these subjects, there are people who tend to paint broadly with very wide brushstrokes. All chiropractic is bunk. Or, no, it's in fact the miracle cure for all ailments. Anything that you are suffering from can be cured through proper chiropractic care. That would be the view of the vitalist. I don't think it's fair to say that with medical studies that show the effectiveness of certain chiropractic treatments on regions of the spine, like we talked about last week, it's not fair to call that bunk. again, if there's scientific data that backs it, again, it's something I think that at very least should be afforded attention. And that's the interesting thing, is that on this program, one of the most important things I've over time felt that my role is as a podcaster is to look at things that sometimes are labeled fringe claims and ask whether there might be a modicum of truth behind some of them. Often what I find might lead me down a skeptical road of interpretation, and I don't like saying or thinking of myself as being a debunker, so I don't say I'm a debunker. Okay, I don't even like saying I'm a skeptic so much anymore, just because I feel that as soon as you choose a label, you almost begin at times to conform to what that label projects onto you. In other words, I don't want to be a person who, by virtue of something I claim to be, this sort of governs my behavior, and therefore if I look at unusual subjects, my intent and my sole objective is to debunk 10 times out of 10. And I see these days that many skeptics and many debunkers operate in that way. If we've got a fringe claim, we don't just look at it critically and raise questions about it, but leave it open-ended. No, they have to debunk to the point that we can explain this. There's absolutely nothing to see here. And 10 times out of 10, fringe claims can be debunked and explained. I don't doubt that 10 times out of 10, if something seems kind of strange and unlikely, that you should doubt it. That doesn't mean, however, though, that you can 10 times out of 10 offer an accurate explanation for the said phenomena. You know, people who claim that they see UFOs and describe very elaborate things that they have seen, nonetheless are told thereafter that they've seen weather balloons, planet Venus, whatever else. And this is the, I think, harmful effect of people who are so sure that such things couldn't exist that they come up with alternative explanations for circumstances that sometimes are as credulous as the idea that aliens are visiting Earth or anything else. In other words, sometimes people may have experiences that we cannot explain, and just because they seem unlikely doesn't mean that we have to try and come up with some explanation. But as a result of that attitude, I've seen skeptical interpretations of certain UFO sightings over the years that fell so short of the mark in terms of accurately explaining all the range of phenomena being described that it was almost laughable. And yet many of those skeptics tend to double down, and even if you point out the flaws in logic of their explanation, at the end of the day they'll at least say, well, but you got to admit my scenario, however incomplete, is more likely than yours. The problem is when we think that in order to be able to be critically minded, that we have to also offer 10 times out of 10 an explanation. That in order to be skeptical, you also have to be able to debunk, and that explanation as an alternative to the fringe claim must be offered 10 times out of 10. And further, that if someone disagrees with your assessment of the phenomena, that they are less skeptical than you, and therefore they're the crazy one. I mean, these are some of the problems that I see with the so-called skeptical movement. And we've talked about it plenty in the past, so I won't, you know, rattle on about that. But for those reasons, I almost don't like calling myself a skeptic. I am skeptical to my core, but I'm also sometimes skeptical of skeptics and their self-assuredness and their certainty that they, 10 times out of 10, have the explanation for everything. Not all of them are like that, but there are a few. And I do think that, again, part of the problem is the cult of personality. I am a skeptic, therefore this is what I must do, and this is how I must interpret everything. Newsflash, that doesn't mean you're right. Even if you think you are, even if you've convinced yourself that you're right all the time because you're skeptical, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're right. The human senses are very fallible. I am as guilty of this as anybody, but as time goes on, I try to do two things. I try to educate myself more and more about science. I try to be cautious but open-minded when I look at fringe claims, and rather than trying to validate them, what I try to do is test for falsehood, and that may not necessarily lead to an alternative explanation. But again, the chiropractic thing is a good example, because you see that there are two warring camps, and it gets very divided. People who say all chiropractic, because some of it has been called pseudoscience, all of it is. And then there are people who say, well, no, I mean, it's helped me, and there are scientific studies that show that it's helpful. Therefore, all of the claims, even the vitalists, are of merit. The truth often lies in the middle rather than between the extremes. That's what I found in my experience. And so it's a good test case. And thank you again, Alden, for writing in and sharing your story about that. Speaking of stories, I mentioned earlier in the program, of course, we lost Stan Lee, and he wasn't the only luminary that we have lost. NBC News now reporting also that Douglas Rain, I'm sure you will remember him, although you may not remember his appearance. It was his voice that you'll recall, because he, of course, was a Shakespearean actor, Canadian also, whose chilling performance as the voice of the homicidal HAL 9000 computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey rendered the amoral emptiness of outer space in sound.
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
HAL, you have an enormous responsibility on this mission. In many ways, perhaps the greatest responsibility of any single mission element. You're the brain and central nervous system of the ship, and your responsibilities include watching over the men in hibernation. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
HAL, despite your enormous intellect, are you ever frustrated by your dependence on people to carry out actions?
Not in the slightest bit. I enjoy working with people. I have a stimulating relationship with Dr. Poole and Dr. Bowman. My mission responsibilities range over the entire operation of the ship, so I am constantly occupied. I am putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think that any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
Apparently he died yesterday, age 90. The Stratford Festival, the Canadian theater company of which Rain was a founding member in 1953, confirmed his death on Sunday night. A cause of death wasn't reported, but they say today we lost Douglas Rain, a member of our founding company and a hugely esteemed presence on our stages for 32 seasons. He will be greatly missed. Our thoughts and prayers are with his family. Now, what's also interesting about this, and part of the reason I chose to commemorate him in the second hour here, is because a lot of people aren't aware of the interesting story behind his role with 2001 A Space Odyssey, how he came to voice HAL 9000, and the broader influence that has had on the furtherance of artificial intelligence and computer science in general. I mean, there's a lot of fascinating little elements that should be tied together here, but I guess we'll start right here. There was an interview in the New York Times with Jerry Flaheve, okay, and he's a filmmaker from Toronto. He had written an article for the Times about how Douglas Rain actually became HAL. Okay, Stanley Kubrick had apparently become very taken with his work on a National Film Board of Canada production called Universe, and apparently Kubrick really liked that. But what he also liked about Douglas Rain was the standard Canadian English accent that he had, which even non-Canadians often find hard to place. And so it was that accent, I think, that Kubrick was particularly drawn to. But the New York Times did this interview with Flaheve, and they said, "Do you remember watching 2001 at the time of its release?" He said, "I was 11 when I saw it at the Glendale Theater in Toronto in Cinerama, and it just completely blew my mind. And that's what got me interested in filmmaking. It almost seemed like a documentary to me." He said, "It was such a realistic depiction of the future. And as I was getting ready to leave the film board, I thought that this is an interest of mine that I could dig a bit deeper into, and so I wrote to Douglas Rain." Now, they asked, "Did the film have a similar effect on Mr. Rain?" Now, this is, again, the voice of HAL 9000. And this is what Flaheve said. He said, "It was just a job for him. It doesn't really mean anything to him, and he's never seen the film." The late Douglas Rain, the voice of HAL 9000, had never even seen 2001 A Space Odyssey. Flaheve continues, he said he was hired to do the narration for what was going to be an elaborate prologue to 2001. They filmed interviews with all these amazing scientists and thinkers to set up the premise for the film and explain the context, but Kubrick stripped it away and didn't use the narration he'd hired Rain to do. And he says, this is important too, "I think if Kubrick had left all the explanatory things, it wouldn't have been the classic that it is." I remember when I was in college and I watched 2001 A Space Odyssey as part of a filmmaking class that I took. I remember watching it and thinking, after I saw it, "What in the hell did I just see?" It took me several subsequent viewings and actually years of thought to formulate in my mind what was really going on there. Now, a lot of people are like, "What do you mean? Come on, he met aliens. They sent him back to Earth as a star child." But there are a lot of interpretations of what's going on there, is what I mean. Again, one interpretation is, was at the end of the film, what's happening in the mind of the astronaut or an actual occurrence? I mean, there's obviously a lot of symbolism and weirdness going on. What exactly did Stanley Kubrick mean? Now, in the book, it's much more explicit. If you read Arthur C. Clarke's actual novelized form of 2001, the things that are happening
which were shown through imagery in the film, the things that are happening in the book are much more rounded out and explained definitively. And so less is left to the imagination. But I thought it was interesting that Kubrick seemed to intend with the film to leave certain things fairly ambiguous so that people would interpret aspects of it. And although there are general ideas of what we see happening in the film, particularly toward the end, nonetheless, the fact that there's an interpretive aspect to it that Kubrick was intending to convey, to leave it open-ended enough so that everyone took from the film a little something different, that's fascinating to me. So New York Times asks Flaheev then, so how did Mr. Rain move from there to becoming Hal? And he said it was going to be Martin Balsam's voice, and even before that, it was going to be a female voice. Hal was actually going to be called Athena and have a female voice. So the voice was probably just a combination of circumstance and a gut choice by Kubrick. He literally said to Rain, I'm not happy what I have in the can, meaning the Martin Balsam recording that he had done a year before. He said, would you like to play the computer? And then apparently a day and a half later, it was done. Rain had gone in and done the voice and never watched the film. Now, Flaheef said, when I spoke to a linguist, he said absolutely that Hal does not have a mid-Atlantic accent, as Kubrick kind of thought. It's standard Canadian English. But anyway, it's quite interesting because I love how many questions were raised about the accent, why Kubrick used it, and all these kind of things. And Rain himself, iconic though that role was, apparently never even saw the film. But I've got an audio soundbite here, and this is another interesting side story too, because as you can assume, if he goes in and has to do the voice later and somebody else had done it before him, while they were on set, somebody was, you know, doing the parts for Hal and they later recorded over that. Kira DeLea, okay, talks about what it was like on the set when they actually had a man with a British accent voicing the parts for Hal. Quite a different portrayal of the so-called homicidal computer in the film than what we're used to and what we remember, right?
Stanley wasn't sure what the voice of Hal should be. The film was filmed in England, and the crew was entirely British. And he turned to his assistant director and said, Derek, you do the voice off camera for the boys. I'll worry about it in post-production. So for us, this was the voice of Hal. Dive, you better take a stress pill, it's all like that. It was a little bit like doing with Michael Caine. Yeah, it's exactly the way it was.
Now imagine for a moment if Michael Caine had actually been the voice of HAL 9000. Boy, it wouldn't have had quite the cinematic punch that it did with Douglas Rain, well, behind the reins, right? Anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting, but there was a paper I was doing some digging earlier, okay, because I became interested in this concept of the influence that HAL 9000 had on culture, and not just in science fiction, but also how the science fiction influences actual creations in the real world. And there was a paper I found online titled From Star Trek to Siri, Disembodied Gender and the Acoustomatic Computer in Science Fiction Film and Television by Liz W. Faber. Okay. I believe this was Ms. Faber's doctoral thesis. In fact, it says on the paper here, it says for the Doctor of Philosophy degree in Mass Communication and Media Arts, 2013 Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. But this is what it says in the paper's abstract. Recent advancements in voice interactive technology such as Apple's Siri application, IBM's Watson, and Google's Now are not just the products of innovative computer scientists. They have been directly influenced by fictional technology. Computer scientists and programmers have openly drawn inspiration from science fiction texts such as Gene Roddenberry's television show Star Trek and Stanley Kubrick's 1968-2001 A Space Odyssey, in order to create more effective voice interactive programs. Such comparisons between present-day technology and past science fiction texts are even more apt than computer scientists seem to have intended. Not only are Watson, Siri, and Now real-world versions of fictional computers, but each of them also hides the ways in which the computer is implicitly embodied and gendered by its voice. Real and fictional computers alike are generally voiced by a human. And she goes on to ask, why do the computers even have gendered voices? In particular, why is Siri, the digital equivalent of a secretary, female? And why hide their voices' corporeal origins? Anyway, she gets into all kinds of interesting things in this paper and raises some great issues. I found it fascinating, but as we see with Arthur C. Clarke quite often, I mean, he predicted in fiction the creation of the telecommunications satellite. You might say that he predicted Skype. You remember the scene in 2001, where the little girl sits down talking with her father at the Clavius Moon Base, and they're having a video chat, and she says she wants a Bush baby for her birthday. Remember? I mean, so there's Skype. We have all kinds of other things that turn up too. But Arthur C. Clarke, maybe more than almost any other science fiction writer, was able to accurately predict things that would come about in the future. And yes, with HAL 9000, of course, we saw the idea of AI, which was the science fictional component that influenced the creation of Now and Siri and any other different varieties of artificially intelligent voices that communicate with us in the real world today. In fact, there was even an article, if not today, recently in The Telegraph that was talking about how Kubrick and Douglas Rain accidentally created Siri. So a lot of people make that comparison. But again, of all the interesting things that turn up in 2001, symbolic or otherwise, one of the ones that I think has captured so many of our minds is, of course, the monolith. That flat, black, monolithic structure that appears at the dawn of civilization and brings intelligence. We later find one on the moon, and that leads to the discovery of one as a radio beacon somewhere out there in orbit around Jupiter, and we go off looking for it. It's as though the aliens have kind of made a scavenger hunt for us with these monoliths, and they have directly altered the course of evolution for humankind. So many little seeds were being planted in that story in 2001, and it's not the only place we've seen it, but certainly one popular iteration of the idea that aliens directly altered the course of human evolution, and that they were the catalyst which led to the intelligence explosion among humans long ago. I mean, there are many people who literally, if you look at ancient aliens, believe that. They think that all of the great discoveries of antiquity, the rise of civilization itself, was the direct influence of aliens coming here and giving that idea to humans. So as unlikely as it seems in the real world that a Prometheus-style scenario happens where, you know, human life is either brought to Earth or it was affected early on by alien visitation, nonetheless, that's pretty much the crux of the narrative in 2001, and some of the best science fiction minds and directors like Kubrick and, of course, Arthur C. Clarke, they coming together, they borrow those ideas from a fictional perspective, which I think only feeds back into the zeitgeist. More and more people are influenced by what they see in the film, and they think, heck, why couldn't it have happened in real life? But coming back to the influences that 2001 has had on culture and society and technology, again, we can definitely see how inspiration behind things like Siri comes from HAL 9000. We can definitely see how other technologies, which didn't exist at the time but nonetheless weren't difficult to imagine, and led to legitimate innovations which we now all know and recognize today. But the monolith. I was wondering, does the monolith turn up anywhere in literature, or is there any way that that might have been influential in some capacity? And this is going to be kind of a weird turn of narrative, because we've been talking about artificial intelligence, but these are the two key factors in 2001. Well, three, I'll say. Artificial intelligence and the role that humans will play with that, that's obviously one part of it. Two, the search for alien life, that's another part of it. What forms will it take? Will we even recognize it as life when we find it? And as we see in the film 2001, the alien intelligence is almost more like an experience. I don't know, they certainly aren't little green men, I'll put it that way. But then there's also the question of, where did humans come from? Did aliens play some role in that or in our evolution? So all these questions, of course, are raised in the fiction of 2001. And it got me thinking, I mean, bouncing over to UFO studies, as I said at the outset of the program, you know, I draw a distinction. I'm interested in unidentified flying objects. But there have been claims from people over the years who say that they've been taken aboard these things and that they've had very unusual experiences. Some of these involve abduction, being taken aboard and taken away, presumably, on these craft. Usually it's a much shorter kind of a circumstance where there's a quick examination of some kind, and then the people are released. They're bewildered. Sometimes they don't immediately remember everything that happened, according to these stories. Now, they were really popular, these so-called alien abductions, in the 1970s and 80s, although the earliest ones actually date back much earlier than that, and we'll see that in a moment here when we look at some of these historic cases. But again, largely, the scientific community has dismissed these sorts of claims. Even people in ufological circles have said that, interesting though the claims are, there is not a shred of physical proof that convincingly demonstrates that there's a phenomenon that is occurring as is being described by those claiming to have had the experiences. And so it becomes very divided in UFO circles because there are the UFO researchers who are very interested in unidentified flying objects, but they could care less about the claims of people who say they've been taken on board these things. And again, I can understand, I can sympathize with that, being someone who hasn't looked at it very much myself over the decade. I mean, I've read plenty about it. I just don't put much stock in those claims. But it got me thinking with regard to the ways that 2001, A Space Odyssey, has had an influence on culture, innovation, things like this. And it got me thinking, I wonder if there are any claims of experiencers that sort of parallel things that we see or ideas or motifs from that film. And so as a kind of segue here, I want to share a story with you. This is from a great compendium of sorts that was put together a number of years ago called Phenomenon, 40 Years of Flying Saucers. And I'll share with you the story of Lee Parrish. This happened, I believe, in the late 1970s. His abductors were, according to the narrative here, machine-like figures. One, a huge black slab-shaped object about 15 feet tall. And they actually say here, okay, in the article, rather resembling the black monolith in the film 2001, A Space Odyssey. These inhuman forms prodded their victim around, and at one stage seemed to push a needle-like probe into his head. He got the feeling that this was some sort of analysis of his chemical makeup. This seems to be a particularly vivid piece of symbolism. The human being, not just as a laboratory animal, more a specimen in a test tube, picked up for analysis and presumably flushed away down the sink when the experiment is over. The fact that this is done by machines rather than by animate humanoids seems to reflect fears of a technological and mechanized society where humans are increasingly irrelevant and redundant. And that passage, of course, by John Rimmer from the article in this collection of essays, which look at every aspect of UFOs, from the history to investigations to theories, and a lot of the commentary is fairly skeptical. And so really what John Rimmer's kind of doing is, in looking at the broader abduction phenomenon, one way of interpreting it is as symbolism, that there's more of a psychological phenomena going on here than literal experiences. A number of researchers have chosen to tackle this problem from that angle, because that both accounts for why there's so little physical evidence to substantiate the claims, and it would also explain why there is, although there's a general kind of commonality, beings of some kind examine people on board what is presumably an unidentified flying object or spacecraft of some kind. That's pretty much the only consistency that we see. Apart from that, descriptions of the so-called visitors from one experience to another, I mean, there's so little consistency. And although a narrative began to form by around the 1980s as a result of popular books on the subject, namely Whitley Strieber's Communion and Bud Hopkins' Intruders, those two books popularized the meme of the gray, the alien gray. But before that, they were all over the map. I mean, little midgets in capes, little dwarves, robots, monsters, reptilians, human-like space brothers. I mean, there was every different kind of alien on board the alleged aircraft in these claims of encounters that you could possibly imagine. These days, you don't actually hear very much in the way of alien abduction reports. They really seem to have tapered off. Why were these things at one time so much more popular? Why is there so much variety? What could possibly account for that? Are any of the claims of abductions actually legitimate? And what can we understand, if not about alien life, at the very least about human nature, from studying these kind of phenomena? Well, I endeavor to try and touch on some of that when we return. There's so much to cover, but we're going to try and canvas a few notable cases and see what turns up as we do right here when we return on the Graylian Report. Back. It is Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report right here keeping you company. And of course, that song, Monkey Warhol, Alien Syndrome. He sent that song along to us a while back and asked if we might want to play that on the show. Perfect to complement the discussion that we're about to have. Although I'm very interested in UFOs, I've always taken a pretty skeptical approach to alien abduction. But that doesn't mean that there aren't necessarily things that we might learn from studying this subject, and certainly that it's not something that's interesting to consider, especially considering the fact that I've met people like Travis Walton over the years and had lunch with him. And again, to me, I find his story very interesting. What do you make of that, though? What does it actually mean? And so, springboarding off of our discussion of AI in 2001, and again, I was just looking at all the different ways that 2001 and some of the imagery in that film has influenced things in real life. That's what kind of got me thinking. I began to wonder, how much obvious symbolism from that film do we see mirrored in things like UFO and abduction reports? There's not all that much, but again, the story of Lee Parrish, that famous incident from the 70s, sounds an awful lot like the monolith from 2001. Literally abducted him. He had this experience where the alien looked almost just like something that we see representative of aliens in Kubrick's film. So that got me thinking about the broader sense and, again, the lack of commonality between these cases. And so I was reading some of the literature earlier, and I just want to share a little bit from the beginning of John Rimmer's essay on this titled Evaluating the Abductee Experience. I think he does a pretty good balanced job looking at this. But he says, within a few years of Kenneth Arnold's 1947 UFO sighting, people began reporting encounters with the ostensible pilots of the strange craft that were invading the world's skies. People like George Adamski and Howard Menger gave accounts of their meetings with friendly extraterrestrials, the so-called Space Brothers, who usually imparted some fairly banal gems of cosmic wisdom. Often the people so contacted were taken aboard the aliens' crafts, usually to be shown the splendor of the visitor's home planet or given a rapid trip around our neighboring planets. Instead of the barren wastes we now know them to be, there were inevitably lush semi-paradises back in those days. Some of these contactees were later exposed as phonies. Some went on to form UFO-based cults, such as the Aetherius Society. And this combination of fraud, cultism, and backyard philosophy repelled serious ufologists who felt that it lessened the chance of having ufology taken seriously as a scientific discipline. Okay, so let's comment really quickly there. This has been one of the problems with UFOs since the advent of them as a cultural phenomenon. There are people who, from a scientific perspective, are trying to analyze and understand and take seriously the prospect that there are aircraft of unexplained origin that we see in our skies. Pretty interesting concept taken at face value. And then there is the, I think they say it best here in this book, this cult-like aspect where people begin to claim that they've had these encounters themselves. And honestly, in the UFO communities, even today, you still see a lot of that. People who claim to have had abductions often have this strange cult-like following. They sometimes form, or sometimes they have formed around them kind of organically, groups of admirers who then suddenly begin to have their own similar experiences. And then they begin to share experiences. Sometimes fantasies are woven into these experiences where some of the experiencers claim to have seen each other in their separate experiences and vice versa, and hence validating the web of myth built around their claims of abduction experiences. Now, again, I'm not trying to attack an entire subculture. I'm just saying that there are some people who claim that they've had this experience. They began to get a degree of celebrity, and then they begin to have followers, and then you begin to see this cult-like element come about. And unfortunately, these people often are able to draw crowds, and therefore they get invited to speak at UFO conferences and things like this. So you've got serious researchers, and I do consider myself in the serious researcher camp, people who go to these events either because we're lecturing on what we are trying to see as something that science should be studying, but then we're having to deal with a lot of claims made by people that, again, I'm not going to say that they aren't true. I have my suspicions, but I'll stop right there and just say I cannot validate what those people claim that they've experienced. Interestingly, nor can they. But unfortunately, that gets a lot more attention. And I think it's because people get wrapped up or caught up in the emotion of that. People are drawn to that, often more so than they are any kind of skeptical or scientific analysis of UFOs. And so I get it that, you know, the cult phenomenon aspect has often been problematic for the serious UFO researchers. And really, it's been like that since day one, because those who were going about trying to deal with these things seriously felt that it just diminished the credibility when these little cult groups form around people claiming that Space Brothers or anything else have come down to Earth and given them a ride on a flying saucer. I mean, I can kind of relate to that. It's still an issue with regard to this subject in the modern era. But we come back to John Rimmer's article here. He says, however, there was another type of contact. Some witnesses claimed to have met not the tall, godlike aliens of the cultists, but more grotesque, truly alien creatures. These were small, gnome-like, with oversized heads and thin, spindly bodies. They did not hold forth to the witness on the state of the universe, but most likely ignored them or treated them with mild curiosity and occasionally hostility. Although many ufologists still rejected all contact cases, others were impressed by these more objective-sounding reports. And I'll just interject here that I think a lot of people, when they hear the word UFO these days, they think immediately of people claiming to go on board a spacecraft and being probed by aliens, and they laugh about it. They aren't aware of the fact that when those reports began to appear, the more serious UFO researchers, they thought that those stories were equally incredible. And they laughed at them, or they just didn't want to hear about it at all. I mean, they may have seen that literally as a threat to the scientific credibility of an already strange enough subject, and they weren't very welcoming of those claims. Rimmer continues here. He says, by the mid-1960s, the Space Brothers had become a historical curiosity, but the alien creatures were becoming a major part of the UFO mystery. The earlier, more mystically inclined contactees went aboard their visitor ships voluntarily. Some of those who met the newer type of alien also went aboard the strange craft, but not of their own volition. And then they start talking about some of the more well-known UFO abductions from over the years. And one of the first ones that they list here actually was from October 1957, and this involves a man named Antonio Villa-Boas. Okay? He was allegedly abducted while he was working the fields on his brother's farm, and the rationale given for why they were out working at night, he was by himself on this occasion, but it was so hot in the summer there in Brazil where this occurred that he had to work at night, and so he and his brother would go out there and they would work. And the story goes that one or two nights before this, they had seen some light in the sky that seemed to be like flashing kind of a spotlight toward them. His brother had been pretty weirded out by this. Well, they thought it had gone away, whatever it was, and Antonio was out there plowing the field. And according to the narrative, this light appears again and starts coming toward him, and he thinks, well, now might not be a bad time to take the tractor back. And so he tries to start the tractor and leave, but it won't start. Now, this is a common theme in UFO reports from over the ages. Equipment malfunction, vehicles and other kinds of equipment not working in the presence of this object, right? Well, in most UFO literature, what happens next is the object, sometimes described as a circular object, sometimes being something that was so bright that he couldn't make out the shape itself, that there was a light on it, whatever it was, but it comes down, it lands, two beings come off, he is taken back on board the craft, and this is where things get really interesting. All right, so interesting, in fact, this might warrant a parental advisory, although we'll keep it PC for the kids. But I mean, so the story goes, he's taken on board the craft and his clothing is taken off of him. And then a beautiful blonde woman, also disrobed, enters the room. Well, nature takes its course. And before she leaves, she, after they have finished what they're doing, use your imagination, she points to her stomach, points to him, and points to the sky. And then he is taken around, shown the rest of the ship after he's given his clothes back, and then he comes off of the spacecraft and thinks, wow, that's crazy. Didn't think that they were going to come down here and do that. Now, it just sounds absurd. It sounds like a completely absurd story, but there are other interesting aspects to this entire thing, which are far less often discussed in the UFO literature. It sounds like a, literally like something out of a sci-fi film. You know, a guy makes love to an alien on a landed flying saucer. Well, first question is, was it a flying saucer? What was the actual aircraft? More on that in a moment. But also, there's the curious aspect of this that Antonio Villa-Boas later becomes a lawyer, and was very successful, never changed his story, but U.S. intelligence services did actually have him come to Washington on a couple of occasions later in his life, and they spoke with him. And there are a lot of questions about what the nature of those conversations might have been about. Antonio Villa-Boas never talked about it. He would never discuss it. Now, I had spoken with Nick Redfern a while back, and I apologize to Greyland X listeners who might have already heard this soundbite in a recent podcast because I was very excited and wanted to feature the fuller conversation between Nick and I on that podcast. I thought I'd lost this audio from a conversation I had with Nick a couple of years ago where the Villa-Boas case came up. And I said, what's weird about some of these experiences, because again, what he described essentially was meeting a woman on board that aircraft. And although she had fairly large eyes, she looked human. She acted human. nothing very alien about this claim. And I said, I mean, surely if it, I mean, he wouldn't have just been picked up on a helicopter. I mean, when he describes a craft of some kind, well, Nick interrupts me at that point and says, now actually, hold on, Micah. I'm just going to let you hear the audio, because the way that Nick describes this aspect of this alleged abduction in a way that I had never heard literally just blew my mind. I want you to hear this.
The stories about the actual aircraft in conjunction with these reports. I mean, if a helicopter or something like that had just landed, I mean, you know, Villa-Boas, you know, you'd think, well, I heard the chopper blades. I mean, he would know what the hell a helicopter is, which is...
Well, just hang on a second.
Oh, yeah?
Let me just give you a quote.
Okay.
This is a direct quote from Villa-Boas's original statement that he made.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if I can find it for you. I'll have a couple of minutes, just a second.
Oh, sure. Take your time.
Now, this is gonna amaze you, not just because of the description, but because so many people aren't aware of what he actually said. And this is not hearsay. It's actually taken from a book called The Humanoids, edited by Charles Bowen, which was written like 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is actually, you know, the original book is taken from. This is what he said of the object. It was shaped like a large elongated egg. On the upper part of the machine, there was something which was revolving at great speed and giving off a powerful fluorescent light. Then he said, as the craft rose into the air, the whirring noise of the air became displaced. Being displaced became much more intense, and the revolving dish that sat atop the object began to turn at a fearful speed. At that moment, the machine suddenly changed direction, making a loud noise, a sort of beat. Now, if you think of a large elongated shaped, egg-shaped object with a dish-like structure above that was revolving at great speed and made a sound like a beat, that sounds like a helicopter.
Wow. Wow, that is incredible. My God.
Yeah. People just don't know that he's described an object that had something spinning around on top of it, making a beating noise.
Man.
You know, they'd be hard-pressed to find a better description of a helicopter. And if you're in some hallucinatory state, well, yeah, you are going to probably, not deliberately, you are going to sort of misinterpret possibly the shape if everything's sort of swirling around in front of your eyes. But he was clear that there was a circular thing on top of the craft spinning at high speed, and it was making a beating noise as it took off. So.
Good God, had the guy never seen a helicopter before?
Maybe not. I mean, don't forget, although in later years, he was someone who became a well-respected lawyer. I mean, when this happened, he was like a 21-year-old farmer living in a little Brazilian village. Now, of course, he may well have seen a helicopter before, but if he didn't get to see the helicopter before he was hit by the aerosol-based hallucinogenic, he might not really have interpreted it properly as a helicopter. You know, you imagine you see a helicopter, but it's kind of the outline of it shimmering or moving, you know, due to the effects of how your brain's affected.
Wow.
He might have thought, well, it's not a helicopter, even though it's got something spinning on the top and whatever. So.
Well, you know, and one more thing, too, Nick. Think about this for a second. The fact that there had been reports that indicated that Antonio Villa-Boas had been brought back to the United States. He had claimed to different kinds of medical conditions that he suffered throughout the rest mm-hmm. of his life, but that U.S. intelligence had apparently taken interest in him and had mm-hmm. and had essentially covered the expenses for some visits to the United States, during mm-hmm. which no one seems to really know conclusively what he was being brought over and questioned about. Yeah, have you seen that? I'll have to dig that up and see, because that just changes the entire scope of that story to me. That is incredible.
Yeah, people just don't know that. They think he just described a flying saucer, you know, and I think the reason why people just assume it and they don't follow it up properly.
Now, he, again, quotes from a book called The Humanoids. Now, I want you to hear, even in this fairly skeptical assessment of the broader abduction phenomena that John Rimmer gives in his essay here, I want you to hear the description that he gives, not to attack him or anything, but I mean, I just want you to compare that with what you just heard from Nick Redfern quoting from the book The Humanoids. So, the following night, Antonio was out working alone when the light appeared again. This time it came closer and hovered near him. He uncoupled his tractor's plowing gear and tried to head home, but his alarm grew when the tractor wouldn't start. Suddenly the light swooped to the ground a few yards away from him and two figures emerged. These were small entities dressed in what appeared to be helmeted spacesuits with some sort of breathing apparatus attached. They seized Villa-Boas by his arms and frog-marched him into their craft. They say very little about the description of the craft, but if you hear what Nick Redfern described, it sounded an awful lot like a helicopter, didn't it? And Mark Pilkington, in his book Mirage Men, points out that cases like this one strongly suggest something along the lines of actual experiences that the claimed abductees may have had, but not with aliens, probably with humans. But why would any human or agency, for that matter, because there were usually more than one involved, but why would they go to such incredible extremes to create a hoax? And to give a guy like Antonio Villa-Boas, a little farmer out in the country of Brazil, the night of his life, you know, one he would never forget, but in order to seemingly do what? What were they trying to achieve? Well, he had this bizarre experience and he talked about it after the fact. What exactly is this experience meant to entail? I think the more important question isn't what was really going on with Villa-Boas, was if someone perpetrated a hoax like this and went to such great extremes to do so, what were they hoping to send home with Villa-Boas? I mean, we still talk about this case. We still read about it in books. And as crazy as it sounds, as absurd, frankly, as it sounds, it's still being discussed. Could it have been that there had been an intentional element here where the aim had been to try and scare a kid or give him a good time, in this case, but that he would go on and talk about it and that it would help plant a narrative related to when we see these aircraft, this is what we associate them with. This kid said he was taken on board the thing and that they were aliens. And this is where the association begins to appear. I mean, that's just a speculation, and it really, I'm borrowing more from the ideas of guys like Mark Pilkington and others when they've looked at that case. But I mean, it's a good question to ask. It could be instrumental in steering an idea or a narrative rather than being an actual case where aliens came down. I don't think they did. And that description that Nick brought to my attention from the book, The Humanoids, definitely sounds a lot more like a helicopter, but this is the other aspect. In other literature that describes the incident, they often don't quote Villa-Boas as he was actually quoted in that book. Later literature kind of mythologizes the incident by, you know, honestly intended, but nonetheless presenting a shorter version of the narrative where they leave out details about the aircraft, which in the specificity of the details given by Villa-Boas pretty clearly point to something like a helicopter having been the so-called spaceship. So what does all that mean? Obviously a lot of speculation there, but it's important to reinterpret some of these cases along those lines. Now, when we're talking about the chronology of these abductions, that one occurred in 1957, all right, in another country. So this wasn't part of the American UFO wave. And in truth, it's debatable whether Antonio Villa-Boas, a farmer in Brazil, really even knew very much about UFOs or followed that. Okay. The next most significant claim of alien abduction that occurs thereafter is still to this day one of the most famous, which involves Betty and Barney Hill. And of course, Betty and Barney Hill of New Hampshire, they're driving along at night. They see a light. This light keeps getting closer and closer. They at one point think that it's following them. They claim that they see what appears to be a flying saucer. There are windows on this thing. There are beings inside the windows. And then when they get home later that night, they realize that they've lost several hours of time. Betty continues to describe dreams that she has of the experience and certain things that she begins to, quote-unquote, remember from the dreams that happened that night. And she shares some of these dreams with Barney, but Barney doesn't want to talk about them. He seemed kind of uncomfortable with talking about this. They finally end up going to a few UFO meetups because Betty's sister had claimed that she'd seen a UFO, and now they thought that they had seen one also. They go to UFO meetups, and finally they undergo hypnosis under Dr. Benjamin Simon in Boston. And this is where the famous UFO abduction narrative comes about, because they didn't actually remember being abducted after they saw whatever it was they saw on the way home that night. This information comes out during the hypnosis session with Dr. Benjamin Simon, where all the details of the examinations and what the beings look like, that's where this information comes out. It was the opinion of Dr. Benjamin Simon that the two had shared, and I quote, a mutual psychological aberration, I believe is how he termed it. And that basically this all stemmed from Betty's dreams after the incident, and that she had shared some of this information with Barney, and that basically under hypnosis they filled in the rest of the details and therefore corroborated aspects of each other's story. Some of the weird things about the case: Barney, of course, said that there was a suction-like device that was placed over his genitals, and this during the physical examination carried out by the beings on board the craft. Now, of course, the fact that there's a sexual component to the alien abduction narrative is not something that is unknown. I mean, it's often discussed by researchers and those who are trying to make sense of it psychologically, physically, whatever it may be. Again, however you look at it, there is quite evidently a sexual component to the alien abduction phenomenon. But there were some weird aspects of the Betty and Barney Hill case. Now, although Dr. Benjamin Simon said he believed that it was a psychological aberration that they had shared that had been influenced by Betty's dreams, interestingly, a bit later on, Barney Hill ends up having a minor surgical procedure. And this had been because there had been warts that had apparently grown in an area around where he said during the experience the so-called suction device had been placed. Now, that's a very odd aspect of this case that isn't discussed all that much, although I do believe Stanton Friedman had talked about it. And I spoke with the UFO skeptic Bob Schaefer about that once. And I said, you know, again, does that seem to indicate that there was a physical aspect to the experience? And Bob said, no, it shows that Barney was cheating on his wife. Now, again, I guess coming from a hardline skeptical perspective, how else are you to interpret that? And I don't want to get into a breakdown of all the scientific methods by which an individual might get warts on any part of their body either. Okay, that's beyond the scope of this conversation, fortunately. But again, the issue I guess I have with so much of this is that often we saw Philip J. Class would do this a lot. And actually, Bob Schaefer agrees with me on at least a few of the shortcomings of Philip J. Class. I didn't know Class personally. He did. David Marler also knew Philip Class pretty well. Class thought that Marler was quite a good UFO researcher. Again, he may have been the arch UFO skeptic of his time, but he certainly respected UFO researchers who went about their inquiries scientifically and methodically. And David Marler had been paid that compliment by Philip J. Class, and he actually told me that story over a Guinness when we were out in Wyoming. I thought that was kind of cool. Again, what I like seeing is common ground between those who are advocates of the phenomenon and those who are looking at it more skeptically. What I don't like, though, and this is something that Class did an awful lot of, is he would resort to the witness attacking. He would look for places where not only there were shortcomings in the story, but he would find ways that he could almost resort to personal attacks against the witnesses. And it was Class who had been the very one who was saying that the story about the genital warts, that's clearly evidence not of aliens, but of infidelity. And, you know, it's not my place to judge. I'm just saying that that was a weird aspect of the case, which is far less often discussed. Kind of like with Villa-Boas, the fact that what he seemed to be describing as far as an aircraft resembled a helicopter. And speaking of the craft, interestingly, in Betty Hill's dreams before the hypnosis session with Dr. Benjamin Simon, she didn't describe alien grays or anything like that on board the spaceship either. What Betty described, she later would describe them as more alien-like. But after her initial dreams following the alleged encounter, what she described were little men with flight suits and hats who spoke with German accents. What's that all about? We won't get into conspiracy theories about Nazi UFOs or anything, but I mean, if you really look at the fine details of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, I mean, the elements of that story were all over the map. And frankly, the way I see it, they very well may have seen an object on the way home that night. But the problem is that after the experience, Betty was very interested in it. She had been talking with her sister, who a few weeks beforehand had seen something also. She begins to have dreams. Barney had no recollection of anything like that at this point. But then she starts talking about the dreams. He didn't like talking about the dreams because he thought it was all fantasy at that point. But nonetheless, he was exposed to her new beliefs about what had happened but that they couldn't remember, which she believed was being revealed to her in dreams. So the idea that, well, Barney couldn't have possibly known about those things, if she was talking about her post-incident dreams to him, it is very possible that he could have had an idea of what was going on, and that during the ensuing hypnosis sessions, that they might have psychologically filled in the spaces and filled out the rest of the story. Now, I don't want to call them liars. I don't think that they were lying. I think it's very possible, especially if they underwent the hypnosis and they believed that that experience occurred, that even if nothing had ever happened, they were probably very convinced of the veracity of the experience themselves. I'm sure Betty and Barney went throughout their lives thinking that this experience actually happened and that there were, at least in his case, some physical evidences of it, which is fascinating because even despite the fact that that seems to be a likelihood, many have attacked Betty and Barney Hill and tried to make them out to be frauds. They were just trying to make money. They were just trying to become well-known. If anything, you got to keep in mind, I mean, at the time, they were an interracial couple in the 1960s. At that time, sad though it is, that wasn't as widely accepted as it is today. And that's one of the unique factors of this case because, of course, at that time, many have said that Betty and Barney Hill, for a number of reasons, wouldn't have been trying to get a lot of attention, let alone trying to become famous for being associated with a UFO abduction. But in the Betty and Barney Hill story, that's where a lot of the tropes of later UFO abductions really begin to emerge. And Rimmer, in his article, lists many of these. A car ride, for instance, is one of these. He says, a great number of abduction cases seem to begin with the abductee driving along a lonely road late at night. There's some ambiguity as to the significance of the car ride in abduction reports. Those who support the idea that UFOs are ET in origin would simply say that most UFO activity takes place under the cover of darkness in lonely places, and that people out in lonely places after dark tend to be in cars. But then there's the other side of it, too. Others claim that people driving in cars at night, especially for long periods, can fall victim to a sort of self-hypnosis, producing a mental state in which they can start seeing things that are not there. At least a possibility, maybe. Of course, missing time was something that Betty and Barney Hill experienced, and which later kind of become one of the lasting mainstays of the alleged abduction experience, that there was a period of time during which you cannot recall what happened, and that this is the missing time where the abduction actually occurred. Medical examinations are another aspect, too. And so, he says, it seems that we can almost create an identikit abduction case. It may not correspond exactly to every case on record, but several elements from it will be present in almost all the cases in the literature, and he lists those as follows. A driver on a lonely road at night is followed by a mysterious bright light, and the light gets closer, resolves itself as a metallic craft, and lands. The witness remembers seeing figures coming from the craft, and then drives off home. On arriving home, an hour or more is missing. The witness is hypnotized, regressed to the time of the UFO encounter, and more details emerge. After the initial approach by the figures, the witness recalls being taken on board the craft. He is shown around the craft, meets other occupants, sees details of control panels, crew living quarters, etc. He is subjected to a medical experience, which may involve the taking of blood samples or some form of sexual examination. And then finally, he or she is given an enigmatic message or shown images on a TV screen before being returned to his car. The TV screen, that's interesting. You know, do they have plasma screens on flying saucers? Many people describe being shown imagery while they're in that environment. That is interesting. Now, we were talking about the chronology here, but again, the Tujunga Canyon Contacts was a book originally published in 1980 by Ann Druffel, but Anomalous Books re-released a copy of it in the 2000s, and Patrick Weege actually sent me a copy of that to review. I found that book interesting because I believe they're pseudonyms that the women use, but Sarah Shaw and Jan Whitley, okay, they claimed that their experience occurred in 1953, March of 1953. Nonetheless, many aspects of their experience are similar to the more modern, and by that I mean the 70s and 80s UFO abduction reports. And that presents some interesting considerations because, again, we see a case that chronologically was alleged to have occurred earlier than even the Vila Boas abduction, but which, in terms of it, the experience is more similar to the later abduction reports, i.e. your Bud Hopkins and Whitley Strieber type stuff. Why might that be the case? Well, Ann Druffel did write the book in 1980, and of course we see similar books coming out during the 1970s and 80s, Ray Fowler's The Andreessen Affair, things like this. My guess would be that the women remembered experiences from the 1950s, but that, again, the UFO abduction lore of the 70s was probably very influential on their memories. Ann Druffel writes a book in 1980, and it contributes to the broader and seemingly consistent now UFO narrative, because at some point along the way, it stopped being little men and beautiful naked blonde women giving farmers from Brazil the night of their lives and things like this. I mean, you start seeing a cohesive element start to appear in the 70s and 80s where the alien gray, you know, small, diminutive beings, big heads, light skin, big eyes, insect-like in appearance, that starts becoming kind of the norm. But we aren't there yet. So Betty and Barney Hill, 1961, right? And I should also note that although Whitley Strieber wrote about his experiences back in the 1980s, he in the book claims to remember things from his youth, which, chronologically speaking, would had to have placed those experiences in probably the late 1950s or early 1960s. So you might say that some of Whitley's own experiences, a later abductee though he was alleged to be, some of his experiences would have fallen within that time period between the Vila Boas and the Hill abduction. But I digress. We come around to the 1973 case of Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. this one extraordinarily strange. October of that year, story's pretty well known. In fact, Parker has written a new book some 40 years now after the experience, where he shares more things that he was able to remember, but he claimed that over time it took a long time for those memories to come back. In addition to the memories of the actual encounter, Parker also claims that there were ongoing encounters in years that followed, but we'll get to that in a moment. The facts of the primary case took place, again, at Pascagoula, Mississippi in 1973. Charles Hickson was in his early 40s, and Calvin Parker was a couple of decades younger than him, but they both worked together at this shipyard, and so after work they would get off and they'd go fish sometimes at night. And on the night in question, they claimed that a blue football-shaped object was seen in the sky. It flies down and hovers low over the Pascagoula River and comes near them, and that it opens, and that apparently two beings, which are often described as being robot-like, but they definitely had organic characteristics. The description that was given, and again, remember, there seems to be very little consistency from case to case to case to case here. We've had little dwarves, we've had beautiful, naked, blonde, human-looking women, we've had alien grays, with the Parker and Hickson abduction, completely different scenario. These things were tall, they had gray, elephant-like skin. There weren't any discernible legs, more like just a single kind of leg that they didn't even hop, they seemed to kind of float out, and hence the comparison to a robotic kind of element to these things. They had claw-like appendages rather than hands, and they had carrot-like appendages where the nose and the ears would be. Very strange-looking things. There are drawings online. Just look up Hickson and Parker Pascagoula Alien on Google. You'll be able to see some renderings that artists have produced over the years, but again, completely alien, even to the established alien lore up to that point. Well, they're taken on board. They're examined by something that resembles an eye. Parker was horribly frightened after this experience. Hickson probably was too, but held it together a little better. They go to the newspaper. The newspaper is closed. They go to the police after that. And famously, the sheriff, in an attempt to try and catch these guys in a prank, leaves a recorder running in the room where he was talking with Hickson and Parker. They didn't know that they were being recorded. And while they were alone in the room together, they are still talking very excitedly about the experience. Calvin Parker is talking about how he thinks he's going to lose his mind. He's praying to God. He's saying, I knew that there were beings up there. He says, we've got to tell the world because these things are coming down here. And Parker especially was scared to death. And he says, I've got to go home. And then Hickson's saying the same thing. So they leave. Sheriff goes in the room, listens to the recording. He's like, well, I'll be there. He figured that he'd catch them admitting to the prank or something. And in fact, they're still talking about the experience they had. Hickson later ends up writing a book about it, I think, and he goes on the lecture circuit, starts talking about the message of peace that he felt that the aliens had actually brought, and that years later he'd had other subsequent experiences where he claims that telepathic messages are projected at him by the aliens. And admittedly, in some of Parker's later recollections, he describes similar things too. And that brings us to another weird aspect of the entire alien abduction situation. I mean, many people will have an experience where, strange and unlikely as it seems, and most of these really seem extremely unlikely. I mean, it really is an awful lot to try and chew, but nonetheless, it starts typically as a more nuts and bolts kind of an experience. We saw a craft. It got close enough we could actually see windows. We could see beings in the windows. In the case of Hickson and Parker, the thing lands. They're taken on board the craft. But again, still, it seems fairly nuts and bolts. Even if it seems outlandish, it's nonetheless fairly nuts and bolts. It's years later that they start claiming messages of love, psychic impressions, things like this, ongoing encounters. And in the case of Calvin Parker, many years later, he said that after the passing of time, he was able to remember what happened while he was on board the craft in the original experience, and said that there had actually been a woman, and that she had done, basically, you guessed it, some kind of sexual examination on him at that time. But he didn't remember it until many years later. So the aspect of people updating the experience years, sometimes decades later, and a narrative kind of emerging that has to do with peace or love, or that the beings are here to try and protect us from ourselves, or to help us, or to warn us about, you know, our destruction of our planet and things like this, perhaps at our own hands through climate change, pollution, all these sorts of things. I mean, these kind of themes often tend to emerge as though people, let's just step out on a limb here and say for a moment that maybe some of these experiences are legitimate experiences that individuals have had with some physical phenomena. appears to be under intelligent control. That experience alone is one thing, but it's the way that later on a narrative is built around it that becomes truly fascinating, as though people begin to kind of ascribe, or where it can't be ascribed, they assign a sort of spiritual or religious experience or significance to the experience so as to be able to almost come to terms with it. It's fascinating to me. You know, another thing that's kind of fascinating about this is, again, I am not trying to tell you that I think alien abductions occur. I find them to be an interesting aspect of the broader UFO mythos. I suspect that the majority of them are probably not imaginary, not people just trying to make money or come up with, you know, silly things because they're bored. I mean, I actually think that probably a lot of these experiences could be inspired by hallucinations, dreams, any number of different things. And you cannot deny the similarity between mystical experiences described even by shaman of ancient cultures and the similarity between those experiences and the alien abduction motifs. Another similarity that is undeniable is those who have taken drugs like dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and they come out of the experience sometimes describing hallucinations that once again are remarkably similar to alien abductions. But then you've got cases of those like Travis Walton. And his has always stood out to me because, like with Hickson and Parker, their initial description, they didn't have to go under hypnosis to be able to remember it. They remembered what they claimed happened that very night. They went to the police. They talked about it. The recordings that were made while they were privately in the room together, they still sound very upset. It at least sounded like something really happened to them. That may or may not be the case. It could have been a great big hoax. I don't know. But it sounded like they were sincere in believing that something had happened to them. With Travis Walton's case, again, I've met Travis, I know him personally, not really well, but we've hung out on several occasions. He doesn't come across to me like a BSer, you know, like somebody who's just trying to get notoriety or something like that. He does speak at UFO events. He did write a book. I think if I had had that experience, I probably would have written a book about it too. I really would have. But what I find extremely interesting about his story and his claims has to do with the fact that there were other witnesses, and many of them don't get along, as I've been told. Alejandro Rojas actually pointed out to me that these guys, they were all there together working during a brush clearing operation at that time, but they aren't necessarily all friends, and they certainly haven't necessarily shared lifelong relationships, only in that maybe they all are part of something that some of them didn't want to be a part of. They saw Travis Walton run out underneath this weird aircraft hovering over this clearing in the forest. They see a flash of light. He goes down. They take off. They think he's dead. And he did actually remain missing for 5 days. People have supposed everything from that he actually got zapped by ball lightning and was in an amnesic state and wandered around in the woods for 5 days. Some people say it was a hoax and that he'd been hiding out in a family cabin. I mean, there are any number of interpretations. What he says is that he woke up on a table, that little beings came into the room, that he was very scared and disoriented, and that there was an object, some sort of a machine on his chest. He grabbed some sort of an object like a pipe and began swinging it. The little beings left the room, and then, when he's in his right mind, a man, a person that looked just like a human. He said he had dark skin, blonde hair, but he was the epitome of his gender. And this man, without speaking, led him out of the room, presumably off the aircraft, and then other beings that resembled humans, he said, took him, put him down on what kind of looked like a cart, like what you might see in a hospital that patients would be moved around on. And basically, he was administered anesthesia, went to sleep, didn't remember anything else. He wakes up on the side of the road with this object hovering over him, and it takes off. And he says he walks to the nearest town and places a phone call from a phone booth. Now, again, that's not to say that there might not be some questions about the story as he tells it. I get it. I mean, I'm the one who's always saying we need to be skeptical, so don't ever take anything at face value. But again, with Travis Walton, unlike a lot of cases where somebody undergoes hypnosis later and says, you know, that all these spiritual things happen, Travis seems to tell a very nuts and bolts story that involved an aircraft. He said he saw basically what were indiscernible from humans on board that craft, and that very earthly technologies like anesthesia were administered to him while he was on that craft. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. And it's, again, I understand for the rational mind, very hard to believe, but nonetheless, elements of that story, like with some of the other abductions that we've looked at over the course of this portion of the show, they have much more down-to-earth insinuations if you read about them carefully enough. If you've spoken with Travis, as I have, and if you listen to the account given, there are aspects of it that sound an awful lot more like earthly phenomena to me than something alien. But then you also see the Hollywood version of that story, Fire in the Sky, the horror film that was based on his book, in which, as he will tell you during his lectures he gives, the film was completely unlike anything that I experienced. The beings didn't look like that. The craft didn't look like that on the inside or the outside. He wasn't naked and losing his mind in a phone booth when they found him, like portrayed in the film. They did all that to make the film scarier, and that was intentional. The original script for the film based more on his book and the way that he told the story. The producers didn't think it would sell. They didn't think it was scary. They wanted to make a horror film. And so part of separating the myth from the reality is, again, recognizing we can't validate claims of people like Travis Walton. You know, I know him. I've met him. He seems like a very nice person, and I've enjoyed talking with him. And I don't get the impression from Travis that he is somebody trying to pull our leg. I don't know. But then again, I've also looked at the fact that there are a lot of different ways of interpreting what the abduction phenomena is. And there's a great book, and we're almost out of time, but I should mention this book. It was written by Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman. Now, Lauren Coleman's best known for his interest in Sasquatch and things like that these days. Jerome Clark, he's definitely taken a nosedive towards skepticism in recent years, which I appreciate about him. He's a very logically minded, what you might call Fortean. And at the time this book was written back in the 1970s, it's called The Unidentified, Notes Towards Solving the UFO Mystery. This book is very different from anything that either of these authors had written up to that point and would go on to write. And in fact, Clark has disavowed the premise of the book, essentially, which looks sort of psychologically at a variety of phenomena related to the UFO issue. And they look at certain abduction reports, and they kind of look at them in the book through the lens of Jungian psychology, and they note the obvious symbolism and things like this that are present in the book. But over at David Halperin's website, Journal of a UFO Investigator, he wrote a little article back in July about this, titled Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman, Descent into Hell and the Bibaduro Abduction. This is a reference to a very unusual abduction where this guy, I think he was in Portugal, although I believe he'd actually been a professor himself and an artist as well. Nonetheless, he claimed he had been abducted by beings that literally resembled dwarves, like from Dungeons and Dragons, taken aboard this aircraft, flown a great distance away, and then again, one of these sentient kind of space brother type beings appears and speaks to him and conveniently speaks his language once again. A lot of questions raised. But as Halperin points out, he says, in my last post in honor of my old friend Jerome Clark in the forthcoming third edition of his monumental UFO encyclopedia, I spoke of the Bibaduro UFO abduction and the Jungian interpretation of it that he and Lauren Coleman published in their 1975 book, The Unidentified. Jerry has since disavowed The Unidentified and speculations he and Coleman set forth in it. But Halperin says, I don't think he should have. Their take on Bibaduro impressed me terrifically when I first read it and continues to do so. Again, in this book, primarily, Lauren Coleman and Jerome Clark. Jerome, very well known for his interest in UFOs. Lauren Coleman, that's not a subject typically associated with him and his research. But they do, I think, a fantastic job, even if they don't agree with the premise many decades later. They did a fantastic analysis of looking at certain UFO abductions through the lens of Jungian psychology. And to me, whether or not that is the ultimate conclusion to this phenomenon, it's a meaningful contribution in the sense that it just goes to show that there is such a variety of ways that the phenomenon can be interpreted. At the end of the day, I don't really know what to think about it. I think that there's at least a possibility that some experiences that people have claimed to have had, like Travis Walton and maybe Villa-Boas, are rooted in real experiences, but that they weren't what they seemed. And by that, I mean the all-too-human elements that are present in the fine details of cases like those, but which are all too often omitted from later rewritings and retellings of the stories in other UFO books. It's pretty evident to me that when people have their minds set on a goal or a certain narrative, whether they are a UFO believer or an advocate, or they're a skeptic trying to debunk everything, when somebody has their mind set on a conclusion, they will write and they will investigate and they will filter everything that they look at through that lens of ideology. And again, I think that the believers are just as guilty as the skeptics and vice versa. If we really look at these cases, though, some of them at least bear a iota of there being a physical reality, whatever that might be, behind them. Hell, for all you and I know, maybe some of these people were actually abducted by extraterrestrial visitors. I just haven't seen a whole lot of evidence of E.T. visiting and hanging around our planet and abducting people and doing tests on them. And that's the whole problem. At the end of the day, we don't have any physical proof that can reliably demonstrate that there is proof of extraterrestrial visitation or any kind of an alien reality underlying all this. Nonetheless, I think that it could bear fruit if we continue to study the phenomenon psychologically, socially, whatever. There definitely may be something to this phenomena that will help us understand the mechanics of the human mind and the human experience. And who knows, maybe on down the road, it'll help us understand aspects of the UFO phenomenon. I think we've got to be careful, cautious, skeptical, but we can't be so close-minded that we rule out possibilities. There may be, at the very end of the day, something we learn from studying these reports. At least, to me, it's a fascinating subject and something at least worthy of further commentary and contemplation. It'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. Thanks, as always, for hitching a ride on our little flying saucer and checking out our corner of the universe. On behalf of all of us here at the Graylian Report, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrell, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, the Graylian Reverend Matt Oakley, and yours truly, I am Micah Hanks. We'll catch you guys again next time, and as always, stay strange out there.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.